In tonight's edition of K-Mud Public Affairs, we take a deep dive into the car bombing of Judy Berry, an event that shook the environmental movement and, 35 years later, still raises more questions than answers. Who bombed Judy Berry is a question that continues to linger. This week marks the 3.5 decades since that pivotal day in Oakland. Berry, a Mendocino local, Earth First organizer, and musician, was severely injured when a pipe bomb exploded beneath her seat. In a car with her fellow activist, Southern Humboldt resident Daryl Cherney, who walked away with minor injuries. Cherney joined us in the K-Mud studio to recount his story in the special broadcast. The bombing occurred during a wave of resistance, known as Redwood Summer, a season of bold demonstrations, tree sits, and escalating political tension that drew national attention. K-Mud News would like to note that not all statements shared in this program have been independently substantiated. We now go to Daryl Cherney.
This is Daryl Cherney. I was an Earth First organizer for almost 2 decades, between 86 and the early 2000s, and I still consider myself an Earth Firster, but I'm not on the front lines anymore.
In the 1980s, Texas financier Charles Hurwitz took over Pacific Lumber in a controversial corporate raid in an effort to reportedly pay off $800 million of junk bonds. In the years that followed, the company shifted away from sustainable forestry practices and began clear-cutting vast swaths of ancient redwood forest in Humboldt County.
Well, Charles Hurwitz did incur a $750 million debt in order to take over Pacific Lumber. He looted his own savings and loan, United Savings Association of Texas, which went bankrupt to the tune of $1.3 million. He worked with Ivan Boesky, Michael Milken, and Boyd Jeffries, all of whom were brokers and all of whom went to prison for these takeovers, including the takeover of Pacific Lumber. However, it's a myth that he began clear-cutting the redwoods in order to pay off the junk bond debt, because he actually never paid off the junk bond debt. He wasn't clear-cutting the redwoods to pay off anything. He also sold the welding operation for $350 million. He looted the pension fund for $55 million, but he never paid off any of the debt with that money. He just used that money to take over, say, Kaiser Aluminum, for example, and maybe to put a bunch of it in his pocket.
He would actually go to court, I believe, in 2009 for defrauding the government as well.
Yes, regarding his failed savings and loan, I did a whole campaign called the Debt for Nature, Jail for Hurwitz campaign, and we had massive petitions sent to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and the Office of Thrift Supervision, which monitors the nation's savings and loans. And we did actually get two lawsuits, one for $250 million and one for $1.3 billion against Hurwitz. Sadly, we did not win those lawsuits. I did go to Houston, Texas at least three times to sit in the spectator area to watch those lawsuits proceed, including the testimony of Charles Hurwitz. So it was a busy time.
Daryl Cherney would travel to Houston for that trial, but Judy could not. She had passed away in 1997, 7 years after a bomb exploded beneath her seat. Many believe the injuries and trauma she endured contributed to her untimely death.
There's no question that that kind of pain, pretty much excruciating pain, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, only 2 hours of sleep a night, will take its toll on your immune system. And honestly, Judy had lost a lot of her will to live. So there was a combination of factors. And when Judy announced that she had cancer in, I believe it was late 1996, and we were told she only had 6 months to live. As it turned out, she only had 4 months to live. It just didn't surprise me. It shocked me. It sent me into tears every single day of the week. Every song on the radio brought me to tears like it was about Judy. But the fact is that it just didn't surprise me. Judy was in so much pain. Just living for her was extremely difficult.
35 years ago, Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney were leaving the Bay Area en route to Santa Cruz for a campus demonstration. aimed at saving redwoods. Little did they know their lives were about to be irreversibly changed. A bomb hidden beneath the seat of their car would detonate on the streets of Oakland. Daryl Cherney brings us back to that fateful day.
Well, in the spring of 1990, Judy and I were gifted the idea to hold a Mississippi summer in the California Redwoods, which became Redwood Summer, fashioned after Freedom Summer in Mississippi. And we took that ball and we ran with it. And then it caught on like wildfire. It was in 1990, Redwood Summer was like Occupy Wall Street or Black Lives Matter or the Me Too movement or so many other really popular movements that have sprung up today or the WTO demonstrations, which was an offshoot of Redwood Summer in a lot of ways. We just galvanized thousands of people to come to the Redwoods. We were all over the media. We were front page in the mainstream press and the alternative press. And it was a big deal. People were coming here to camp out. Judy and I immediately started getting a slew of death threats, about three dozen in all, between April 10th and the time of the bombing. In fact, we got some after the bombing, too, which was May 24th, 1990, literally just slightly more than 35 years ago to the day. And we believed that somebody was going to try to kill us. And we actually got our affairs in order, if you can believe that. That's how much we were sure somebody was going to try to kill us. And then on May, so one of the things I did was I organized a college tour in order to get out of Dodge, you know, like still do the organizing, be like Freedom Summer in Mississippi in the 1960s, except organized college kids. I did all the CSU and the UC campuses, not all of them, but many of them in California. And that was a great idea. But on May 24th, 1990, just a day after we finalized all the plans for Redwood Summer in Berkeley, California, at the Seeds of Peace House, Judy and I got together at Dave Chemnitzer's house. He was an organizer for Seeds of Peace and, may I say, also an interesting character in this whole story, which we could, you know, there's so many characters and suspects and people with questionable motives. It's clearly a conspiracy what happened. There's no question about it. There was more than one person involved. But on May 24th, 1990, I went over to Dave's house to meet Judy, where she had spent the night. I had spent the night at Seeds of Peace House. We worked on getting a grant together for to the Grateful Dead, the Rex Foundation. We argued like crazy. She was just chewing me out for having too many men in my slideshow, which I didn't believe was true, but she wasn't going to let go of that. And then we decided to rehearse just before we went back to Berkeley to pick up the banjo player, George Shook. And so we rehearsed and we sang two songs before we left because, as Judy would often say, I can't hate you when we're playing music. So we sang, and then I had a choice of two cars to get into. The car I rode in on, which was belonged to Shannon Marr, who worked for Seeds of Peace. My banjo player, George, had borrowed my van to get a part for his banjo. Or I could ride with Judy. And being kind of a person who casts his fate to the wind or to the spirits, I stood between the two cars equidistant, and I said, who should I ride with? And Judy went, me. And as I later said, I called out to the universe to see who I would ride with, and Judy said, and the universe answered. So I got into Judy's car, and Shannon took off ahead of us like a bat out of hell. Judy and I were talking about just trying to keep up with Shannon on our way back to Seeds of Peace House. When we got into Park Boulevard, right in front of Oakland High School, reality had changed forever. A bomb had gone off in the car, although I didn't know it was a bomb at the time. The car came to a skidding halt to the left side of the road, crashed into some kind of barrier by the pedestrian crosswalk, and two kids came running out of the school going, it's a bomb, it's a bomb. And that's when I realized that we had been bombed. And I immediately started telling Judy, I love you, I love you, you're going to live. I was trying to keep her awake and also trying to just let her know that she was going to live. But when that bomb went off, I knew, like right then and there, as soon as I realized it was a bomb, that I would never be the same again. Well, in my brain, the car, there was this crack, And then we started skidding. I still see the car kind of like the bottom of the car hitting the road as we're heading toward Oakland High School. And the first thing I thought of was, oh, God, we got hit by a logging truck again, because just 8 months earlier, we had been rear-ended by a logging truck. But then my brain said, no, wait, we're not in logging country. And then I thought, well, maybe we've gotten run over by a train like Brian Wilson had his legs cut off at the Concord weapons station about a year before. I said, no, we're not near any trains. And then maybe we got shot. But then I realized that there was no gunshot. And then I thought maybe we were in an accident, but I realized my head hadn't gone through the windshield. All these thoughts went through my head. I was trying to deduce what happened. I also, actually, my very first thought was that I was dead. But everything was ringing. My ears were ringing because my eardrums were flapping. And I had no frame of reference as to what had happened. I literally thought I was dead. And then so all of this happened probably within 10 seconds.
You would come to find out there was a pipe bomb.
Later on, we learned it was a pipe bomb. I just knew it was a bomb because the kids said it was. They watched the car explode. They took me out of the car first, and they were very rude to me. The paramedics were very rude. I didn't know why, and I kept saying, "Take Judy first, take Judy first." And I didn't want to leave her side, you know. And they said, "No, you got to come out." And they were really exceedingly rude to me, which why I find out later that the police had told them at that point that we were suspects or that we were bombers. And in fact, they made that decision pretty much within 5 minutes of the bomb going off. And in fact, we would later learn through our lawsuit against FBI agents and Oakland police officers that Special Agent McKinley with the terrorism division was literally 5 minutes away. He claimed he was shopping for an apron for his daughter for the school play Little Women. And I just want to be clear that we were in the hood in Oakland. We were right by Highland Hospital. And it's just not what you would call apron shopping territory. And so, but they were there within 5 minutes, and then within 20 minutes, the chief of the terror division, Special Agent Frank Doyle, showed up and immediately declared that we were guilty.
Judy would be in serious condition and remain in the hospital. You would actually go to jail.
I, by a miracle, was only slightly injured. I was told that since it was a pipe bomb, perpendicular to the seats, that the hump where the transmission is deflected the blast of the bomb, which came out the end caps, and it also made a dent in the door. But it went right through Judy's pelvis and went upward, and big hole in the middle of her driver's seat. Her pelvis was shattered. Her leg was partially paralyzed. She had intestinal damage. She was impaled, a 2-inch hole in her butt where she was impaled on a car seat spring that spiraled into her. She had this giant hole that she had to lay on that hole while she was in traction. The whole thing was just nightmarish. And then by a miracle, I just had a couple of busted eardrums and some burns and a scratched cornea. But I walked out of there. And, you know, there's a saying because in show business, because Judy and I were on our way to perform at UC Santa Cruz that night. And I was like, this is before we were arrested, but the show must go on. I was walking. I was up. Even though my head was ringing, I was ready to go do the show. I could have gone down south and told everybody that we were bombed and galvanized support and all that kind of stuff, but that was not meant to be because Special Agent Phil Sena and Stockton Buck walked into the hospital room and asked me what happened and who could have done this, and I gave them a list of suspects, people who had sent us death threats or people who were involved in the disinformation campaign publicly. And they said, look, we can tell this is your bomb, so why don't you confess, make it easy on all of us, and get it over with. And that's when I realized, because I'd been reading Agents of Repression by Ward Churchill, that's when I realized that we had just fallen into the same category as the American Indian movement, the Black Panther movement, the Brown Power movement. And it was hard for me to believe that little old us, we were, you know, powerful people, you know, good organizers in the Redwoods, but I didn't think of us in the same category as, say, Leonard Peltier or Geronimo Pratt or any of the other, you know, amazing people who had spent, you know, decades in jail even then, right? And yet there we were. And, you know, Klandaiken has this great song called In Search of Enemies. And one of the things they said, well, the FBI ran out of enemies, so they decided to come after us.
The FBI and law enforcement alleged that the bomb was in the back seat, made and placed there by the activists. However, Daryl believes the bomb was placed under Judy's seat by an unknown assailant in an effort to assassinate her.
Well, I happen to be in possession of the back seat right here in Southern Humboldt County. Not the car, but the back seat. And the back seat, it doesn't even have a nick in it. It's a couple of Coca-Cola stains for the girls might have been drinking some soda and stained the seat. And when took him to trial, and we asked one of the FBI agents to show us the part where the back seat was blown to smithereens. He says, well, we knew it was in the back seat because the back seat was blown to smithereens. So we brought out the intact back seat, and we said, well, show us the blown to smithereens parts. And he showed us the little stains, soda stains that are on the back seat. But before he even did that, he got up out of the witness stand, and he tripped over the seat. Another moment of humor, and there was many, by the way, during our trial against the FBI and Oakland Police. And then the other thing, the other reason they said that we were guilty, and by the way, I mean, it was obvious that the bomb was hidden under the driver's seat. But another reason the FBI said we were guilty is that nails, which were in a bag in the way back of Judy's station wagon, which were roofing nails because she was putting a new roof on her house, were identical to nails strapped to the bomb, which were finishing nails. So they were saying that the roofing nails and the finishing nails were identical, and therefore we were guilty. And, you know, those nails are as similar as a Volkswagen and a Rolls Royce. They're both cars, but they don't look alike. Judy was a foreman, and she called herself a foreman at California Yurts, working for David Raitt, Bonnie Raitt's brother. And she was in charge of a six-man construction crew and building yurts. And one of the reasons she could be a foreman, well, she was good at math. You got to be good at math to be a carpenter, and you got to be real good at math to build a yurt, a wooden yurt.
Before the investigation and the trial, Daryl was in jail, and Judy in critical condition.
Judy was in the hospital. She was handcuffed to her hospital bed. She saw that there were police officers there, and they wanted to talk to her even after she came out of surgery, and she had the presence of mind to say, I want to talk to a lawyer. I, on the other hand, was taken to the Oakland jail around 4 o'clock in the afternoon of May 24th and held there till 11 p.m., 7 hours in this little room with no food or water or bathroom privileges. I had to bang on the door to go to the bathroom, and a cop would come in and scream at me, and I'd scream right back. So I have no business being here. You guys need to be out there looking for the bomber. And finally, at 11 o'clock p.m., they walk in, and they say, will you sign this? If you'll talk to us, just please sign this. And it was basically, you know, kind of waiving my rights. And I'm a pretty smart guy when it comes to the law. And I know you're not supposed to talk to cops, but I also knew there was this other part of me that wanted them to go find the bomber. And also, I was pretty grounded in what had happened and in my own innocence. And I know that that could be naive, but it wasn't for me. And so when I signed it, I didn't sign it just ordinarily. I said, yeah, I'll talk to you, and I am absolutely willing to help you whatever it takes to go out and find who the bomber is. I just wrote that down before I signed it. And then we talked for 4 hours. And one of the things that the Sergeant Sitter had said to me during this conversation, talking to me about, you know, Earth First and Redwood Summer and the bombing itself, he looks at me and he says, you know, you just don't fit the profile of a bomber. And I said to him, no, Sherlock.
Although coerced confessions have been used as a law enforcement tactic, Cherney said that wasn't the case during his interrogation.
Not really. You know, I'm kind of a talkative guy. I think I kind of, it's like, okay, enough. And so at the very end of 4 hours, they had to make a decision whether to let me go or put me in jail. And it was like, you know, all nerves. I was right there, and they said, we're gonna put you in jail. I was like, God damn it. I probably said something a little more profane than that. And then they threw me in a holding cell for a while, which was interesting. It's who was in the holding cell and the different kinds of people that were in there. And then I got put into another holding cell, which had a payphone. And I picked up the payphone, and I was like, oh, there was a dial tone. It was like, oh my God, there's a dial tone. And I was a media person, and I knew the phone numbers by heart of like 80 or 90 press outlets. And I called K-Mud right away and did the sort of the famous K-Mud interview. It's on Daryl Cherney's SoundCloud. You can go just look for interview from jail, or Daryl from jail is what it's called on SoundCloud. It's really, if I may say, you get to hear me like right after the bombing. It's good interview. And so there I was in jail, and then all kinds of things happened. Hundreds of people were outside the Oakland police station. They were drumming them into insanity. They were there was 24-hour demonstration there, and I wasn't there for that. I have lots of footage of that. And then inside, I still remember this really tall sergeant, like really like 6'6", and he says to me, "You know, we're treating you with kid gloves in here." I'm like, "I shouldn't even be in here. The hell with the kid gloves." And then also in jail, they gave me a holding cell by myself. They gave me a jail cell with like 8 beds all to myself. They didn't want anybody near me. And I remember at one point I was in there for 5 days because it was Memorial Day weekend. And the so you get held Thursday and Friday. Then the weekend, you don't get out. And then Monday was a holiday. And I needed a freaking toothbrush. And a jailer who was there, a Latino man, I asked him for a toothbrush, and he came up to me, and before he handed me the toothbrush, give me your hand, he went like that. He gave me a power handshake, but it was like, you know, I had friends in all places. And then the big tall guy comes up, he says, "I have a list of media who wants to talk to you, do jailhouse interviews." I said, "Please show it to me." And it was right out of almost out of a comedy. He pulls out this paper. It almost rolled into the ground and almost out the door. And I said to him, "Look," I said, "I know you guys don't want the press in here. And I'm not really that anxious to talk to anybody right now. So how about this? I'll talk to the Oakland Tribune and we'll call it a day." Yeah. And so he was happy with that. I talked to Robert Lopez of the Oakland Tribune.
Even before the bombing, Judy and Daryl were making headlines in both mainstream and grassroots press.
Well, the thing about the mainstream press was that Judy and I, especially me, but Judy as well, were constantly talking to all the press all the time, especially about Redwood Summer, but even before Redwood Summer. And one of the interesting things about Humboldt is we have an airport here, right from the Bay Area to Eureka. And so Mendocino County doesn't have an airport, a national or international airport. We have a national airport. And so Humboldt is kind of a hub for getting reporters up here from the Bay Area. And so so the press was actually, they knew who we were. I was their contact. And I don't think that the mainstream media gave us that bad a shake. I think some of the print media did, because what they did in the newspapers was they took the environmental reporters off the beat and put the cop reporters on the beat. So in that sense, we got a little bit of a short shrift. But looking over it all, it wasn't as bad as it sounds. And also, we were the top story because we had people with their VHS machines collecting every single piece of news coverage. We were the top story in the Bay Area. We pretty much occupied the first 15 minutes of television news in at least 3 or 4 stations for 3 weeks. It was always us and Redwood Summer, and they came up here to interview people. It was amazing. We were the thing for a while there.
Depending on the outlet or agency, Daryl and Judy were referred to either as victims or as suspects. Daryl walked us through what happened after he was released from jail and the subsequent investigation into who planted the bomb.
Well, as far as law enforcement goes, there was no investigation. There was zero investigation. There was a sham investigation in which they made things up and then went ahead and looked for things. Like they said, "Well, we're going to see if the nails in the bomb match nails in Judy's house that she's," and they would go pull finishing nails out of the window trim. And then they would go to hardware stores and buy bags of like 20 nails. I didn't even know they sold bags of 20 nails, but they would do this. And then, of course, one of the interviews was with the little old nail maker. And he said, "Oh, you know, nails are made in batches of millions and millions, like 3 million nails at a time out of one die. You know, kind of like you can tell the signature of a nail like you can the signature of a bullet." And no, with nails, it's not the same. So that said, there was no investigation at all by them. They weren't even looking at us. The whole thing was a sham. They knew we were innocent. And that's the whole point of the trial, was not that they were mistaken that we were innocent, that they were lying. I mean not that they were mistaken that we were guilty, but they were lying in telling people we were guilty, which was a violation of the First Amendment to the Constitution. You cannot prosecute somebody for their political stance. That's a violation of freedom of speech. So I've been asked, well, do I think the FBI bombed us? And I would say, well, first of all, they were certainly complicit in that they covered the tracks of the bombers, so they were accomplices in the bombing without question. And then, you know, were they involved in the bombing directly? I would say, well, I cannot say that at all, but they sure act like it.
What's Judy's famous quote?
Oh, yeah. She was asked by KPFA News, what are your demands of the FBI? And she said, find the bomber and fire him.
When asked whether he believes the case was mishandled due to incompetence or conspiracy, Cherney says both.
Yes, well, in our own investigation, in which I was probably the lead investigator, both in investigating myself, who bombed us, and also hiring investigators as well, is something that I did. During the course of the lawsuit, we learned that 30 days before the bombing, the FBI held a bomb school at College of the Redwoods up outside of Eureka, and they were blowing up the insides of cars with pipe bombs, recreating the scene that would happen a month later, and they were doing so on a Louisiana Pacific clearcut. And right there on scene was Frank Doyle, the main guy we sued, the head of the FBI's terror division, yucking it up with his old friend, his literal old friend and bomb investigator, Frank Wigginton, the chief of security at LP. They knew each other. They knew each other because they were both bomb technicians, and they were both, you know, law enforcement at various times. And so there you have it. It's on the eve of Redwood Summer. You know that the FBI already had two big busts of Earth First, one in Arizona and another one in Montana. Arizona was a complete setup. And then Montana, they arrested like seven or eight of the wrong people, eventually found the right person years later. And so you have them yucking it up about Redwood Summer and Earth First because it's foremost on their mind. Both the FBI and Louisiana Pacific are thinking about Earth First, and there they are together, blowing up cars. Now, 2 weeks after bomb school, we read in the papers that a bomb went off at a Louisiana Pacific sawmill at Cloverdale. The southernmost sawmill that Louisiana Pacific had in the North Coast. One that was not even on our radar, one that had zero protests, and a sign had been left behind that said LP screws mill workers. It was a pipe bomb attached to a gasoline can, which did not go off. It did not set a fire. It was put on the porch of the little office that they have there. So then 2 weeks after that, the bomb goes off in Judy Barry's car, almost killing her, injuring myself. And who shows up to the bomb car, but the guy who taught bomb school and one of his students from the Oakland Police Department. And that's when Frank Doyle says on videotape, this is it, don't you think? This is the final exam. So you have LP and the FBI blowing up cars on April 24th. Then 2 weeks later, around May 8th-ish, you've got a bomb at the Louisiana Pacific Sawmill where Frank Wigginton shows up. So LP bomb school, LP mill blows up. And then 2 weeks after that, on May 24th, you've got the teacher of bomb school with one of his students at the bomb scene. So you have a direct thread between Louisiana Pacific and the FBI and the bomb car. And so I've always felt that it was Louisiana Pacific who called for the bombing, not Pacific Lumber. Plus, more their style.
What's the intersection there with
Louisiana Pacific? Well, Judy Barry lived in Mendocino County. She lived 80 miles south of me always. And we talked every day. We saw each other at least once a week for 9 years. But she lived south, and that's where Louisiana Pacific had its holdings, and they were cutting what Judy called the baby redwoods, like third growth cutting, and really stripping away the soil. And so she made Louisiana Pacific and the baby redwoods her mission. But of course, the Humboldt people went to Mendocino, and the Mendocino activists came to Humboldt all the time, right, nonstop over, you know, like a decade or more than that. And so that's how, so there was this interchange, and it was constant. We just helped each other out. All of us helped each other all the time. There was one more thing I forgot to mention. Well, two more things, actually. One of them was Judy's union organizing. Because Judy was a real union organizer at the United States Post Office, where she was vice president of the the bulk mail center postal workers, and she led a wildcat strike. And her picture is in the Washington Post in 1974 with a bullhorn, her instrument of choice. And so she was a leader at the postal workers union in Washington D.C. And then she also organized a strike with the retail clerks union, also known as the cashiers, people who worked at Safeway and places like that. And she also did newsletters for them. She was actually sued by the United States Post Office in 1974 for making their logo from an eagle into a buzzard and calling the newsletter. She changed it from Postal Life into Postal Strife. And they sued her for copyright infringement. Of course, she won that lawsuit, but that's 1974. I mean, Judy's been at it for a long time. And then the other thing that happened through her union organizing, both at Georgia Pacific and Louisiana Pacific, she had sawmill workers wearing Earth First shirts to work in the sawmills. And then they even a couple of them came to boards of supervisor hearings with Earth First shirts on, mill workers. Then she goes to the Mendocino County Board of Supervisors and asks them to declare eminent domain over all of Louisiana Pacific's hundreds of thousands of acres of holdings in Mendocino County. And that's when the death threats really started, when Judy started to advocate for the seizure, the government seizure of LP's holdings in Mendocino County. And there was one more thing that was happening. It was a perfect storm, and that was we had Proposition 130 on the ballot. There was a ballot initiative to end clear cutting in California, to increase stream protection zones, to a bond, same ballot initiative, to a bond to buy Headwaters Forest, and a bunch of other environmental regulations. And that would ultimately go on to lose by one percentage point in 1990. But my name appeared on the ballot initiative arguments against it. Said, don't vote for Proposition 130 because Daryl Cherney's a terrorist and he supports Proposition 130. And we went to court to try to get my name taken off the ballot arguments and failed. And that's a whole nother story.
Louisiana Pacific had extensive operations in Mendocino County. Judy Berry's vocal opposition to LP's practices and her efforts to push for the company to relinquish its land did not sit well with corporate leadership. However, Berry succeeded in something few could, uniting loggers and environmental activists under a shared cause.
But Judy had a silver tongue, to say the least, and she also recognized me accurately as being somebody who was very empathetic, sympathetic with timber workers. I've always appreciated hardworking people. I never saw them as the enemy, and Judy and I clicked on that immediately when we met, along with the fact that she played the fiddle and I played the guitar, and we were both, shall we say, funny. And so we were both very much into organizing the loggers. In fact, a year or two before I met Judy, I put out a newsletter which I mailed to post office boxes. It was called the Save the Loggers League, and it was sent to Riodale and Scotia PO boxes about how the companies were losing, we're going to lose all the jobs or get rid of all the jobs in short order. And so I was doing that long before I met Judy.
The movement Daryl describes was unfolding at the same time as Julia Butterfly Hill's historic two-year tree sit in Luna, a towering redwood slated for logging. It also coincided with the tragic death, some say the murder, of activist David Gypsy Chain, who was struck by a falling tree during a protest. All of this was happening as both state and federal agencies were under increasing pressure to re-examine critical forest policies.
We were a story. We, in fact, I would say if you look at the people involved with the Headwaters campaign, the Max Am campaign, from Cecilia Lamon at Epic and Robert Sutherland from Epic and Richard Ginger and Judy, myself, Greg King, of course, who just wrote A Ghost Forest, The Ghost Forest, Larry Evans, and oh my God, the list is endless. You had Rainforest Action Network, Greenpeace, of course, Epic, Sierra Club. You had about 10 or 12 different organizations. It was an all-star cast. And in my mind, I'm saying to myself, if this group, the A-team, can't win this battle, then what can anybody ever win against a corporate state? And while we managed to save, 5 or 10,000 acres of redwoods, they're logging, the rainforest the size of Kentucky every year in Brazil, and don't think we're not aware of that. But one of the things that Judy and I were very intent on doing was setting an example and teaching others, showing others how to wage a nonviolent direct action campaign.
This complex environmental movement was unfolding before, during, and after the bombing. We asked Daryl to bring us back and explain what happened after he was released from jail, and how the investigation into the bombing continued to unfold.
Well, as I like to repeat, like a mantra, we were never actually investigated. We were simply accused. They attempted to frame us with no real evidence and no real facts behind their accusations. But what happened was, I went to court three times. Once after I got out of jail after 5 days, 2 weeks after that, and then like 2 or 3 weeks after that. And the district attorney, Chris Carpenter of Oakland at the time, refused to press charges because he wasn't in the loop. Their interest was not in seeing us prosecuted. Their interest was in dragging our names through the mud. Remember, there was an election. They needed to tarnish environmentalists as terrorists. They needed to stop Redwood Summer. They needed to stop Judy Barry and her union organizing. And they just had to bug up their butt about Earth First in general anyway. Not to mention the fact that the Oakland police and the FBI have a long-standing relationship, especially against the Black Panthers. And we have lots of evidence that shows their interfacing before the bombing occurred. That said, there were never any charges filed. And then 5 days after the bombing, somebody takes credit for the bombing, the Lord's Avenger. And the Lord's Avenger describes two bombs accurately to the T. The one that happened 2 weeks before we were car bombed, the bomb that went off at the Louisiana Pacific Mill in Cloverdale, and then the bomb in Judy's car. And the Lord's Avenger, in very flourishy language, you know, I built with these hands the bomb that I placed in the car of Judy Barry. Doubt me not, for I should tell you that the design is only I shall know. You know, the Lord's, you know, made him bomb Judy because she led the honest men of in the woods astray to follow her pagan gods. Judy was an atheist, by the way. She was not a pagan. But that's a whole nother story, okay? Anyway, although she did come into goddess sense toward the end of her life, it was a very interesting transition. That said, so now we got somebody taking credit for the bombing. And he described the bomb at Cloverdale, the size of the bomb, the color of the wires, the brand of the pocket watch, the brand of the battery, the way the wires were twisted. And he described the bomb in Judy Barry's car. Same thing, the brand of the battery, the brand of the pocket watch, the size of the pipe, the materials that the bomb was made out of. And so the FBI says, well, if the Lord's Avenger was so intimately familiar with the makings of the bomb, he must have been one of Judy's and Daryl's friends. Oh, great. Yeah, our buddy, the Lord's Avenger. So, and by the way, this letter was written while I was in jail. And Judy was in the hospital. Neither one of us could have possibly written the letter. Yeah, and we couldn't have typed it out beforehand because who knew what the nature of our injuries would be? And the Lord's Avenger said that they tried to bomb Cloverdale first to bring infamy down, to try to frame Judy Barry for bombing the mill. And when that failed, he had to strike at the demon directly. So that was, you know, that didn't change the nature of the investigation. But what I believe is that why was the Lord's Avenger letter written in the first place? So first of all, if you know the composition of both bombs, there's only two possible people or two entities that know what the bombs are made out of and how they are built: the bomber and the FBI, who has possession of both bombs. So, you know, without getting too far ahead of the story, you know, 10 years later, we tested the DNA of the Lord's Avenger letter. And this is when DNA in the year 2000, the science was still young, very young, and they do it much differently now. And the composition of the DNA of who licked the stamp and who licked the envelope of the Lord's Avenger letter, it was female. It was an unknown female licked the Lord's Avenger letter, which, you know, begs the question, did the Lord's Avenger have a secretary? Or was the Lord's Avenger a woman? You know, I mean, it doesn't seem likely, but, you know, keep your mind open. And then we also tested the DNA of death threats, and not just death threats, but a police informant letter as well. And we zeroed in on the Irv Sutley family. In fact, Irv Sutley himself, who was a Communist Party member, a police informant, a known police informant, out in the open, in fact, gun enthusiast, nothing against gun enthusiasts, but Irv was the token gun nut of the left. He had no he's kind of a Stalinistic kind of guy who would not accept any difference of opinion other than his own. And quite a few months before the bombing, a photograph of Judy was sent to the Ukiah Police Department of Judy holding an Uzi, and Irv had posed Judy with his own Uzi to take pictures, and I thought, oh, maybe they might make a nice album cover. There's a picture of me strumming the Uzi like a guitar, you know, like you beat their swords into plowshares kind of thing. But one of those pictures, the one of Judy, made it into the hands of the Ukiah Police Department with a letter. That letter not only had Sutley DNA on it, but it had information from a single conversation that Irv, Judy, and I held at El Azteca Mexican Restaurant back in, I believe, 1988. All kinds of details, like maybe throwing an oil-soaked rubber duck in Congressman Bosco's swimming pool, and Irv tried to buy pot from Judy through the mail. That was in the letter as well. And it also said that Judy Barry had initiated automatic weapons training with Earth First. And so there was all this stuff had transpired at that conversation that only Irv knew, the DNA, and and the photograph was in Irv's possession. Because he was the one who posed it, and his roommate took the pictures, but Irv had access to the photographs and was seen not just rummaging through the photographs by his roommate, but also sent another one of the photographs to Bruce Anderson of the Anderson Valley Advertiser, did so openly. So Irv's a suspect. He sent Judy her first death threat. Judy Barry, get out and go back where you come from. We know everything. You won't get a second warning. And I got the typewriter. The typewriter was at where Irv worked, at the Sonoma County Peace and Justice Center. I have the typewriter right here in Southern Humboldt. And I could go on this down as a manual. I think that was an Olivetti or an Olympia, one of the brands that begins with an O. And all roads pointed to Irv. Irv, unfortunately, passed away in the last, say, 6 months or so. And I can only tell you how angry I am that Irv Sutley died, because I wanted to nail his butt to the wall.
You think he's the...
No. Keep in mind, female DNA on the Lord's Avenger letter, male DNA on the death threats. This is a conspiracy. There's more than one person involved. At least the DNA shows that. So I think there's more than that. So then, I mean, we're talking about an investigation. So somewhere before the bombing, or maybe it was, I'm sorry, somewhere either just right around the time of the lawsuit, which was 2002, when we sued the FBI and Oakland police for First Amendment freedom of speech violations and Fourth Amendment illegal search and seizure and false arrest violations of the U.S. Constitution, they closed the case. Both of them closed the case. And we were able to get our evidence back eventually, a few years later. But in that time, that's how we got the DNA, was the FBI handed us over the evidence and we tested it for DNA, not just the Lord's Avenger, but other pieces as well. So what that leads me to is the fact that both agencies closed the case and returned all the evidence basically to me and our attorneys. That means there's no case. There's no open case. It can't be a cold case, because in order to be a cold case, the case has to be open. If you close a case, it means the case is closed, can't be solved. We're done. We're done with the case. We don't want any. And so when you return the evidence to, say, my lawyers and myself, the chain of custody of evidence dissipates. So I could show them, Lord, you know, DNA, but it doesn't matter because the law enforcement doesn't have the DNA anymore. The only agency that has an open case, and they might debate this, but I believe they have an open case, is the Mendocino County Sheriff's. And we met with the Mendocino County Sheriff's. Alicia Littletree organized this meeting about 6 or 8 months ago down in Ukiah on Logap. And they expressed an interest. Hey, we're all getting older. In fact, I would tell you, not only are we getting older, the case is getting older. The evidence is getting older. The anniversary is getting older, 35 years. And they said, you know, we really want to know what happened. This is the elected sheriff and lieutenant and the captain are all there in the room with Alicia and I. And I say, we're gonna send this information down to the U.S. attorney in San Francisco. Now, this is before the new administration came in. This is before the election. I don't know how it would all be seen now, but honestly, it wasn't seen very well through all the different administrations. Because as I have, when I talked to the Mendocino County Sheriffs over the years, Tried to get Irv Sutley to come in for a polygraph test. Failed at that. I mean, he wouldn't come in. And provided them with other evidence, as I'm involved with that, they'd say, hey, we work with these guys. We need to have a good relationship with the FBI. And so, I mean, who investigates the investigators? That's the question. If you don't have, you know, I might know who the bomber is. What am I going to do? Well, knock on his door, you know? Now, speaking of who the bomber is, I do have a theory here at first year on KMUD, and that is that right after the lawsuit in which we won $4.4 million in 2002 and collected it in 2004, right after that happened, I got a letter or a phone call or an email from one of our volunteers, a quintessential rainbow hippie who had a pickup truck, drove from the Midwest, I think Kansas, to Oakland to help us out. We had scores of volunteers working on the actual lawsuit itself, the trial itself in Oakland. Even the building donated office space.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, we had a support group there. Anyway, the guy goes back to Kansas and he sends me an email. He says, and this is, by the way, the guy's a complete hippie. He drives a pickup truck, so he was very popular for moving our stuff around. We had concerts. We needed to move PA system and T-shirts to sell. And so the guy with the pickup was like, you know, the guy, right? Anyway, so he writes back. He said, now, you might not think by looking at me, Mr. Rainbow Man, that my favorite television show is the FBI Files. But it is. And guess who was on the FBI Files this week? Your defendant, Special Agent Phil Sena, the guy who in the hospital, blame me for being a bomber. And guess what Phil Sena was doing on the FBI Files? Just before you guys were bombed, he was working with a pipe bomber in San Francisco as an informant. And it's right there on television. Our guy is working with a bomber, a criminal, as an informant to catch a cop killer in Mexico because the informant, who was also a pipe bomber, had helped the other guy escape. It's kind of a convoluted story, but the point is, there's Phil Sena himself. They changed the names of the bomber, not of the suspects, but Phil Sena kept his real name and his real face on Discovery Channel. I have that show, and so now I'm thinking to myself, okay, so this guy helped a cop killer escape to Mexico, and he's a bomber. Why not say, hey, you know, you done time, hard time in prison. You want to go back to prison, or you want to make a bomb and put it in Judy Barry's car on the evening before May 24th? You know, because the FBI has a long history of using informants and criminals to do their dirty work. For example, Whitey Bulger of the Boston Mafia was allowed to go, and a hitman was allowed to go killing whoever he wanted to kill, as long as he provided information to the FBI. And of course, we can look at Dr. King and other famous cases. But that said, so I do have a name and a suspect. But when we researched him, he seemed to have disappeared off the face of the earth. When he went to trial in Boston, because the cop killing was in Boston, he was given witness protection, new identity, boom. And the guy wasn't even a mobster. He was just who he's testifying against. And yet this guy was disappeared off the face of the earth. So without law enforcement to help dig us, find out who this guy is and whether or not he was involved with the FBI and the FBI allowing him to put a bomb in Judy's car in exchange for not going to prison for helping a cop killer escape, we can't know.
Again, KMUD News would like to note that no one has ever been charged in connection with this case. While the investigation is considered closed, no suspects have officially been named, aside from Judy Barry and Daryl Cherney, who were both cleared by the FBI. The two later won a landmark civil rights lawsuit, Judy Barry and Daryl Cherney versus the United States, for violations related to their wrongful arrest and the mishandling of the investigation.
You know, this is all conjecture. It's hard. And that leads me to the fact that there's no case, open case, except maybe the Mendocino County Sheriffs, and they don't really want to handle it, although they have been open and friendly and will meet with us when asked. And so you can't be a cold case if nobody is keeping a file on it. So the FBI has no file. The Oakland Police has no file. I have bomb fragments that they were returned to us in my possession in storage right here in Southern Humboldt, you know, and some of those went to the Mendocino County Museum for the display. But once I receive those, they are no longer, the chain of custody is broken. And by the way, when I did get the evidence given to us for testing, I did have the Cloverdale bomb tested for DNA and fingerprints. So remember, 2 weeks before Judy's car was bombed, the bomber put a bomb at the Cloverdale Mill, allegedly trying to frame Judy for that bombing, perhaps. In any case, and that bomb didn't go off properly. So we have a fully intact gasoline can. Maybe there's fingerprints in the bottom of the can. Maybe there's DNA in the bottom of the can. Maybe there's fingerprints on the bomb itself. So we brought it to a lab. But this is what the FBI wrote to us in a letter. They said, you might find our fingerprints on the bomb. Because it's like, oh, really? Well, surprise, surprise. Is that because we treated this as a civil case, not a criminal case. And so therefore, we didn't need to use gloves if it's a lawsuit and not a criminal case. As if the bombing of a sawmill isn't a criminal case. I mean, we were dealing with the stupidity and the arrogance and the gaslighting of the FBI from day one. And one of the things that one of the jurors said, Mary Nunn, who did her interview here on KMUD, she said that our side, Judy's and my side, we didn't have to testify at all. We didn't need to say a word. The FBI lied so bad on the witness stand constantly all the time that they were clearly guilty of something without us even having to, you know, testify ourselves. And, you know, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts, absolutely. And, you know, somebody in the FBI says, oh, Darrow and Judy are the bombers. And next thing you know, and the elevator's on the way up and down and the offices, the gossip goes out. And then you've got the whole, you know, agency thinking that we're bombers. But really, it was a conspiracy. Without question, it was a conspiracy because we had multiple DNAs in this case from multiple people. And it was also incompetence. But at the end of the day, Judy Barry lived the remaining 7 years of her life in agonizing pain without ever having justice brought to her. She didn't get to see the end of the lawsuit, which our lawyers and myself and Judy's estate took to the finish line. And, you know, her kids got a good chunk of the money, and Judy left some of her money to a nonprofit as well. But it wasn't $50 million or $80 million. It was $4.4 million, of which we settled for $4 million. And nobody got rich off this case, but we won.
In 2002, Darrell Cherney would win the landmark civil rights lawsuit against the FBI and Oakland police, stemming from the 1990 car bombing that injured Barry and their subsequent arrest. The jury found that law enforcement had violated their First and Fourth Amendment rights by falsely accusing them and mishandling the investigation. Although Barry had passed away in 1997, her estate and Cherney were awarded a combined $4.4 million in damages. And with the funds, Darrell would make an iconic documentary.
Who Bombed Judy Barry, which is on YouTube for free. I also have it on DVD. And I have it in four different languages. So yes, Who Bombed Judy Barry tells a good chunk of the story. It's my gift, my treaties, my honoring of Judy Barry. And it did win 7 awards at film festivals. We entered it into the Oscars. We didn't win, but we did enter it into the Oscars.
Winning the case was a major milestone, a moment of vindication. But it wasn't exactly a celebration. So much still remains unanswered. As for what comes next in the independent search for truth, with advances in DNA testing and forensic technology, there's renewed hope. We asked Darrell whether he believes we'll ever truly find out who bombed Judy Barry.
Okay, so DNA, very important question. The way that they tested DNA in the year 2000, which is when we tested it originally, is not the same as the way they test it today. And so we had 16 markers back in the year 2000. And I've been told by DNA experts, and I have continued to see if technology can be even more advanced, that the way they test, that the piece of paper that we have with the Lord's Avenger letter on it, the letter taking credit for the bombing, that those DNA markers cannot be interfaced with the current DNA markers that they do in the year 2025. And the Lord's Avenger letter itself was returned not to me, not to Judy, not to our lawyers, but to the Santa Rosa Press Democrat, because that letter was written to reporter Mike Janella of the Santa Rosa Press Democrat. And the Santa Rosa Press Democrat, which has an archivist, lost it, air quotes. They lost that letter. This letter of immense historical significance, there is an archivist, doesn't know what happened to it. And so we can't retest the Lord's Avenger letter because it doesn't exist. And oh, by the way, and who bought the Santa Rosa Press Democrat at the time that this letter was lost? Former Congressman Doug Bosco, one of our arch enemies, a timber Democrat, a guy who is in favor of killing indigenous peoples in Central America, people in favor of offshore oil drilling, in favor of the timber industry. Doug Bosco, who I ran against in the Democratic primary in 1988, after only being here 2 years, wrote quite a few songs, including Where's Bosco? And there's a California congressman that no one's ever seen. Where's Bosco? You'd think he was a wanted man, the way he can't be found. So Doug Bosco bought the Press Democrat, and poof, the letter disappears. There has been some inquiries of the archivist, but they've not been able to produce it. Now, here's the bigger question, or the more important question, can we somehow or other have an expert translate those 16 DNA markers, female DNA markers from the Lord's Avenger letter, and make them compatible with current DNA markers, current DNA testing? And the answer is, I've been told no, but technology continues to advance, and I don't really see it as the final answer, because we do have DNA. But if we wanted to test it today against, say, the female prison population, which they have DNA for, those DNA markers don't match up with the current DNA markers. Hmm. And I also looked into female bombers, too. I also looked into female bombers, too, you know, keeping an open mind. And, you know, there was that woman who shot a doctor in the Midwest. I believe she went to prison, and she lived up in Grants Pass, actually, north of us.
Your theory, right? Let's just say that's the theory and what happened. Why send the letter?
I can answer that question for you. Why was the Lord's Avenger letter sent? Well, it's important to know that I got into Judy Barry's car by accident, or by happenstance, or by fate, as I would like to think of it. I stood in between two cars. We could drive back to Seeds of Peace House. We were in Oakland, heading to Berkeley. I had a choice between cars, and Judy Barry ordered me into her car. Well, if I had gotten into Shannon Marr's car, the other activist who was driving back, what would have happened then? Oh, I'm the ex-boyfriend. I'm the guy who's fighting, screaming, and yelling with Judy just before the bomb went off, in fact, top volume. Plenty of witnesses have seen us arguing at top volume. I tried to kill her. That would have been to get rid of both of us. Judy is dead, and now I'm arrested for murder, premeditated murder, no less. Okay, that was the plan. Judy saw that as a definite possibility. I mean, we can't know for sure. But I got in the car by accident. I wasn't supposed to be in the car. So if I wasn't in the car, they could have blamed me for bombing Judy. But I got in the car, and that really screwed up their plans. And if you know anything about the FBI, and I've read, you know, 20, 30 books on the FBI, is that they don't improv very well. You know, look at Waco. You know, look at Ruby Ridge. Look at a lot of different. They don't do improv. The FBI likes to plan an arrest in advance and then go in and make the bust. They're not street cops. They don't have to think on their feet. So now they're like, shit, we're going to blame Daryl, but we can't. So what are we going to do? Who's going to, you know, Daryl's blabbing his brains out on the telephone from jail, and Judy's alive. We didn't kill her or him. So they created the Lord's Avenger letter as a red herring, as a decoy, as something to distract, not just and they were still able to blame us, saying that we wrote the Lord's Avenger letter. That's how the Lord's Avenger letter came to be. They needed both a red herring and something else to blame on us.
Yet they would never investigate anyways.
No, they never took the Lord's Avenger's DNA themselves or fingerprints themselves. They never compared our fingerprints to anything themselves. And as soon as we sued them 1 year after the bombing, the FBI and Oakland Police had the right the legal right to question us under oath a year after the bombing in 1991. And they never, ever, ever, ever chose to question Judy Barry ever. And we had to fight like hell to get Judy to do her deposition. And we were the only ones who asked questions because she was going to die within weeks after the deposition. She had terminal cancer and we needed to get her testimony. They didn't want it on video. We had to wait 4 hours to get the judge to say, of course you can video her deposition, which we wanted because the FBI didn't and the Oakland police did not want a sympathetic character on video. But at the end of Judy's 2 days of testifying on video, the FBI and Oakland police attorney said, no questions for the federal defendants, no questions for the Oakland defendants. They never asked Judy a single question. They had the opportunity to do so for the last 6 years of her life. And they never asked me a single question, even though we were banging down their doors, literally my lawyers and I, to talk to them a few days after the bombing. We were willing to talk to them. They never wanted to talk to us. And eventually they questioned me under oath before the trial because I was alive and kicking and they had to.
Well, to quote them, their fingerprints are probably on it.
Yes.
Daryl, what else should we add?
Well, I think it's something that I'm always going to work on, finding out who bombed Judy Barry, as well as promoting the legacy of Judy Barry as a historical figure that I have a unique relationship to. She was my organizing partner. She was my romantic partner for a while. We were very close. We argued terribly, and we were at odds much of the time. But when she was on her deathbed, her last conversation, which I recorded, I called it Judy's Last Instructions, she said, you need to carry on this lawsuit. You're the only one who knows what happened. You're the only one who can really do this. And so we had that kind of relationship. So my job is to make sure Judy Barry is known as an historical figure. But I'll always be keeping my eye out for who bombed Judy Barry and my ear to the ground.
That concludes tonight's edition of Public Affairs, where we spoke with environmental activist Daryl Cherney, revisiting the car bombing of Judy Barry, an event that shook the environmental movement and, 35 years later, still leaves behind more questions than answers. Who bombed Judy Barry? It remains an open and haunting question. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Lauren Schmidt.
Who bombed Judy Barry? I know you're out there still. Have you seen her broken body? Or the spirit you can't kill? Judy Barry is a feminist organizer. Ain't no man gonna keep that woman down. She defended the abortion clinic in fascist Ukiah town.